What if every day you had the chance to experience more love and intimacy in your life? We're going to be sharing stories of struggles and triumphs in love, sex, and relationships, along with expert advice to create more conscious connections. Enjoy this podcast with Dawn Richard. Wake up to real love.
Hi, everyone. This is Dawn Richard, also known as The Awakening with Dawn, and this is the Wake Up to Real Love podcast show, where we share stories of struggles and triumphs in love, sex, and relationships, along with expert advice to create more conscious connections. I'm super excited today to welcome my friend Mary Kay Ranger. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, Dawn. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Mary Kay is a beautiful, beautiful woman. We met couple years ago, year and a half ago, something like that, on Clubhouse in a beautiful room, excuse me, about spirituality and clearing your throat chakra, which we were just talking about. And we have so much in common. We have a lot in common. And so we are going to have an amazing conversation. Mary Kay, as an early childhood colored and shaped by bullying and a life of living other people's expectations, Mary took full responsibility for and control of her life. She left behind her marriage, including her marital assets, house, child support, spousal support, as well as her legal career, to revive her dreams and her freedom to live a life that lights her up. Through her holistic coaching practice, Mary Kay helps Gen Xers and baby boomers step into a more fulfilling life and a brighter future by addressing the barriers that are holding them back. She's also a journalist and freelance writer for the award-winning Spy Witness News and Paranormal Daily News. Love that. Various publications on Medium and the Holistic Network, and offers writing services to those needing expert assistance and breadth of knowledge to publish quality content for their business. Welcome, Mary Kay.
Thank you, Dawn. I'm honored to be here. I love your podcast.
Thank you. I love you. I know. I love you too. So I'm going to start off, because we've had a whole conversation before we started recording, but you and I were both bullied for our hair growing up. And now, I mean, you probably get compliments on it all the time. Oh my gosh, your hair's so pretty. Your hair's so beautiful. But what was it like? Because this is, you know, this is like training ground for life. When you're a kid and you're getting bullied for something that you have absolutely no control over, how you look, what your hair looks like. So what was that bullying like for you, Mary Kay?
Oh boy, it was, I mean, it set the trajectory for the rest of my life up until I took control of my life. So I moved to Canada in the 70s. I was 6 years old, entering grade one. I had this big poofy curly hair. And I also had an English accent. So I had a target on my forehead. There was this one girl, and I won't tell you her real name. We'll call her Rachel. She was the leader of the pack insofar as bullying was concerned. Mm-hmm. And I was the current, you know, flavor that year in grade one. And she even used to follow me into the bathroom and
pinch grade me one, and make age bruises. Six. Age six.
Grade one. That's yep. So, I mean, you and I can both probably, you know, say now, I didn't know back then, but what was that poor kid going through that she was putting me through that? Like, right. I can just imagine, my heart breaks for that girl. So it was a few years of that. Luckily, my parents decided to move out of the house we first bought in Toronto. We moved a little outside of Toronto. Mm-hmm. At the same time, Farrah Fawcett and Charlie's Angels came.
The flip.
On the TV screen. Yep. And that was my, you know, big hair is not a big deal. In fact, people want it. And it was my first taste of we can all be different. Like the three Charlie's Angels were all different. And it was okay. And, but unfortunately the bullying, even though I escaped my bullies physically, I had created my own version of that in myself, in my head. and became my own bully and became my own, you know, biggest critic. Now, you know, that's where that started. And then my own critic being formed inside. And, yeah.
So what kind of things
did you criticize yourself for? What kinds of things? Oh my goodness. Yeah. Everything. So coming from a Greek family, I had the cultural lens on top of everything as well. Greek girls do this. Greek girls don't do that. You know, you find a man, you get married. So there was that pressure, those expectations. And so if I didn't feel like I was fulfilling the role that was laid out for me to the perfect level that I thought was expected of me, then I'm going to criticize myself. So I'm not doing a good job. I'm not good enough. My brother is a year younger than me. So I was in charge of him as well. And, you know, I allowed him to be a kid, but not me, right? Mm-hmm. I was house cleaning. I was cooking. I was doing everything because we were latchkey kids as well. You know, very typical of the 70s and 80s. And so very, very critical of myself. And then at the same time, approval seeking, right? I needed somebody to validate that I was doing a good job and that I fit into whatever role I was playing for them. And so that colored my teenage years as well as like well into my adulthood.
Mm-hmm. So who were you seeking approval from?
Anyone and everyone. So it started with my classmates and my parents. It turned to approval from my friends. So whatever they were doing, I had to do it as well and be good at it as well. So it was really everyone. And then when I found boys, it was seeking approval from boys and later men. Yes. Mm-hmm. And teachers. I was always teacher's pet.
Oh, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Huh. So you feel like it's both this sense of internal criticism as well as that, I guess that manifests as people pleasing.
Yeah, it definitely manifests as people pleasing. And you know, everybody else was the director. Like, see, it's picture being in a movie and you have a director. So you have that director. You need to follow what that director says and the script that's been written for you. And measure myself against that. So maybe I was my agent, if you want to do it in movie terms. And, you know, giving myself, taking points off. No, Mary, you didn't do that very well. Go back, you can do it better. And then whatever the director was directing me to do.
So did you get approval from these people that you were seeking approval from?
Oh, I did. I did. And that was highly addictive, right? When somebody's validating that you're doing a good job and a good job is important to you, then it is completely lighting up the reward centers of your brain. So then you're going to do it more and you're going to be, you know, chasing dopamine. And I did. So I got straight A's in school. My teachers were happy. My parents were happy. I fit in with my friends. I could pretty much be whatever they wanted me to be. If they wanted me to be the comedian, if they wanted me to drink, right? Like a whole number of things was me playing the roles, getting the validation, then becoming addicted to that source of pleasure. Yeah.
And so how did that impact you when you got married?
Ooh. Well, let's back up for a second. So before I met my husband, now my ex-husband, I was engaged to someone. Mm-hmm. And he became very tired of my approval seeking. So even things like we would go out and he might be covertly, like not overtly, he might be eyeing you know, this beautiful blonde woman that's sitting next to us. And so I took that as I need to go dye my hair blonde so he can like love me more or mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. So I went into this marriage with that kind of a mindset. So he got tired of me and he left. And then I met my ex-husband. And so I took the same thing. So I went from my parents' house to my husband's house, right? We bought a house together. And again, he was the head of the household. He was the one in charge of, this is all in my mind. It wasn't a partnership. It was me being the person that I thought he wanted me to be. So that's really where it came. So the driver of my behavior and my interactions with him were all kind of vetted through a, like, is this what he wants? Is this what he wants me to be? Is this what he wants me to do?
And would you ask him that? I mean, was this No, it was just a movie in your head.
It was a movie in my head. It was, you know, had I known about communication the way I know now uh-huh. and self-awareness, we would have communicated a lot better. And those would have been questions that I would have asked him. And so not only did I think he had a script for me, which I thought I had, but I also had a script for him, which I didn't share with him.
Mm.
So I'm holding myself up to this role that I think I'm supposed to be in. And then I'm holding him up to a script that I've written for him that, of course, he has no clue about. And he can't meet those expectations uh-huh. if he doesn't know about them. Uh-huh. So, yeah, that was my 30s.
Did you find in your house your brother was playing the same type of role or roles, you know, like people pleasing, validation seeking?
No. So my brother was very different, and there was a big double standard in my family growing up. Men do this, women do this. So insofar as he was expected to meet the Greek man male stereotype, yes, he was definitely doing that.
Uh-huh.
Happily, it seemed. So he didn't have to deal with bullying. For some reason, the grade behind me was more diverse and didn't matter because he had curly hair too uh-huh. and an accent. So no, he pretty much had the freedom to explore, whereas I was mostly like, girls don't date until they're 18 or until they're married, right? So he was exposed to more of the world than I was. And I think that was his greatest, greatest asset, greatest friend, is that he saw that the way that our household was run. And don't get me wrong, I had a beautiful childhood. My parents are beautiful people. And they were doing the best that they could at the time, especially it being new immigrants and with those mm-hmm. stresses. So yeah, sorry, long way to get to the answer. No. My brother didn't live the same with the same lenses, same lens glasses.
Okay. So how did that impact your relationship and your marriage?
Well, I think without having dealt with the fact that I didn't feel the freedom, didn't feel I deserved the freedom, didn't feel I was good enough to drive my own life. Eventually that was like a, what do you call those things? Pressure cooker.
Mm-hmm.
So those things were repressed and put down. And then at some point, as I'm going towards my 40th birthday, it all exploded, and it exploded in my being, in my soul. If you want to call it the dark nights of the soul, mm-hmm. that's what was going on. And, my son was 5. He was young. And it just felt like I knew there was more out there. And my career, same
how,
thing. My
how
career
did you
was
know?
Circling.
How did you know?
Well, my health. I think my health was definitely on a downturn. I was starting to have digestive problems, not knowing that where they were coming from. Getting emotional. So most of my life, I was able to be on a very flat affect, like flat emotions, priding myself on that, right? I could compartmentalize this over here and put that over in that box, and very masculine, really masculine energy in that. But it worked for me, right? It totally worked. So when those emotions started coming out of those boxes, I was either very anxious or I was very low. So no longer flatline, but I was actually like, if you picture a heartbeat
right
on a monitor, that's right. What I was doing. And I wasn't used to that. I was not used to that. I was so used to being able to control my emotions. And
I was just going to say, be in control.
Being in control. Control of myself.
Yeah.
And so it was also manifesting in my career. So my legal career, I was in intellectual property law. I was working mostly like cease and desist and in trademark infringement matters and things like that. And I became very emotional at some of the cases that were going on. So in one case, and I can't, you know, divulge confidential information, but there was one case where it was a mom and pop kind of shop. My client was like the big bad corporate client that wanted us to get them to stop using a trademark and design that was somewhat similar to the one that the corporation had. Mm-hmm. And maybe it was a little bit similar. But there was a distinction between what that corporation was doing and what this mom and pop shop was doing that, in my opinion, was enough to just let them do whatever the heck they wanted. Mm-hmm. But no, the corporation wanted us to get them to destroy their inventory, destroy their printed things that had these trademarks on them. And anyway, it was just like we're shooting down this mom and pop shop mm-hmm. for the client. And I'm the one that had to do it. Like I had to get that cease and desist letter drafted. I'm the one that had to go back to their website and find all the evidence to throw at them and demand that they were going to destroy all these trademark designs and things like that. And I didn't know what that would mean for that company. Were they going to now go under because of this thing that I was doing, even though it was a late job?
Right.
So that just started affecting me more and more. And again, it was being under the direction of somebody else because I'm at the direction of the senior partner and what it means to be in that role. So all this stuff has come into a head and my 40th birthday is on the horizon. And something just snapped. Like as I was thinking about it and trying not to sweat this small stuff, as I called it, it was gonna break me open, completely broken open, and initiating that conversation with my husband to say, hey, you know what? This is not who I am. This is not what I want. This is not, I can't remember the words that I used. And, you know, I probably would have used different words now and hurt him less.
Yeah.
So yeah. And then same thing with my employer. Within 2 months of each other, I was in a different home, different career, and celebrating my 40th birthday with my friends.
Wow.
Yeah. Big changes.
Wow. Big changes. Huge, huge changes. Yeah. So what was the fallout from your marriage first?
Well, at first my family, so my parents and some other family were not supportive because they thought I'm going to ruin my child. I'm going to ruin my life. How am I going to manage without a man? You know, very typical Greek or European thinking. And it didn't take long go ahead.
Did you have like the perfect marriage from the outside?
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. I think so. I never spoke to my mom about some of the problems we were having or some of the things that I was thinking. So yeah, to them, it came out of the blue. And even to my ex, it came out of the blue in some ways because I hadn't communicated some of these things with him, to him. Yeah. So that was part of the fallout, was trying to get the support of my parents. But I did say to them, the first 40 years of my life, I have lived your expectations I've done it for you and I've done a damn good job. And I'm getting emotional, sorry.
Don't apologize.
Yeah. And then I said, the next 40, those years are for me. Mm. And like, this is your notice and you're going to support me or you're not, but I'm going, I'm ready.
How did they respond to you?
Shock.
I was going to say, cause this is like out of the blue, right? They had no idea that you were carrying all of this inner turmoil and expectations and stuff within you, trying to meet their needs. Yeah.
So about trying to meet their needs, that was the only time I really talked about it to them. I didn't want to burden them with like, did we ruin our daughter? Uh-huh. Right. I didn't want to go into all that with them. Uh-huh. And I didn't want to go into my mental health either, because mental health was something that we didn't talk about. We talked about physical health. My mom has a nursing background. She's a registered nurse. But we didn't talk about mental health. So we didn't go down that road. And it was just a matter of me committing to myself. I just need to show them that I'm okay. Right. So let them come to my son's soccer games. Let them come and hang out with me whenever they want, and their grandchild. So it was more showing them and not dealing with the past. Mm-hmm. Like showing them I was okay. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's what it looked like. That's what it started to look like. And when I left my marriage, one thing I did was I waived child support. I waived spousal support, any kind of financial support. I took a small bit of our assets to put a down payment on my own little tiny house, you know, compared to what I had. Mm-hmm. Let him have the house. And because I didn't want that typical fallout. I had seen some of my friends go through that really, really hostile divorce situation and what that could do to their children. Didn't want that to happen to my child. And my ex-husband's a good man. I didn't want to ruin him. I wanted him to keep what he wanted to keep. So the deal I made with him was basically, look, you can have all this stuff. I don't want anything from you going forward, except for one thing. I want you to pick up your child every day after school. A boy needs a relationship, not just with his mom. He needs a relationship with his dad. And up until then, my ex was a little hands off. Well, this was going to force him to spend at least a couple of hours a day with our son. And it was great. So of course, you know, he's the ex-husband that can't say a bad thing about his divorce or his ex-wife, right?
Wow.
He can't say that, you know, she raped me financially. She put me in a whatever situation. So he was committed to being a good co-parent going forward, you know, without the hostilities.
Which is shocking, because I've had a couple podcasts ago, two conversations with two different people who they were the exact opposite. Like their ex-spouses purposely manipulated and, you know, did things to try to prevent the other person from having a relationship. And I think, what's in the best interest of the kid? Unless there's like some major, you know, safety issues around the child.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, if there's some safety issues, but these two guests were both accused of things that they did not do. And they spent years in court trying to disprove. And I think, how is that serving your child? Because eventually your kid's going to learn, hopefully, the truth, you know, that the truth will come out. So kudos for you and your former husband for creating a really stable transition and beautiful arrangement that the two of you say, we love you. And that's the most important thing.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. That means a lot.
Yeah. So are you two friends now? I mean,
I wouldn't call us friends.
Ish.
But I ended up, When I moved into a different house, I bought a house just off of his street. So my street cuts onto his street. So now we're even closer physically. So there's times that I'll come home from wherever I am, and I'll find him home, like in my house with my son, with our son. We don't go to dinner or vacations or anything together. So I wouldn't call us friends. I think we're more like just family. Right? We're more like family. Family that kind of hangs out sometimes and, you know, doesn't make a big deal of anything really. So yeah, we're still good. We're still Jimmy's parents, right? We're still Jimmy's mom and dad.
Yeah. So how did you deal with your own internal mental and emotional state when you left?
Well, I started, so I have a degree in psychology and cognitive science. I studied disorders, never admitting to myself that I was a person living with anxiety. And it's now a heck of a lot worse, right? Now that I'm on my own trying to figure things out in a new place. So the one way that I dealt with it was I asked for help. I went to see a counselor for the first time in my life. And that was, and I didn't tell anybody, right? Perpetuating the stigma myself.
Right.
I went to see a counselor, and I kind of framed it in the way that, to the counselor, I'm here to make sure that I'm not crazy. Like, think about that language. And it's my ex-husband that's crazy, and it's all his fault, and blaming everything that had come before, but deep down knowing the truth, knowing that I had responsibility in everything that happened and in some way created it. So that was my first string of therapy session.
And how did that help you on your healing journey?
I want to say it got worse before it got better.
Can you talk about that? Because I'm sure there are listeners who are experiencing that or have experienced that. And this is part of this, let's normalize all this stuff.
So coming out of the therapy sessions, I was getting a view into the things I had repressed. The shadows, the stuff that was in the shadows, and we were shining this big old spotlight on it. And those things still hurt. And because I had gone down that flat affect compartmentalization technique.
Technique,
yeah. Tool, in my mind, that's what it was.
Funny.
Then I actually started feeling things. So not just the good things, but also the bad things. So those were gonna hurt. So my childhood bullying and pulling up some of those memories and how I could sort of rewrite them or reframe them. Well, I had to feel them again. So to your listeners here, it did hurt, but I knew that I was gonna be okay. So it was okay for me to cry for an hour or 2 hours or whatever. Let it out, just breathe, and then move on to the next thing. And it was a lot of opening and opening things and then closing them, reframing them. So that's what it looked like at first. And then I got better at recognizing the triggers in myself, something else had come up. Although I did get into an abusive relationship right afterwards, right after I was single. And that was somewhat familiar to me. Not that I had been abused in the past, but that control over me, I went, even though I was in therapy, I still went seeking that controlling personality. And that's okay. Like I want your listeners to understand that we're not perfect. Like, this journey is not perfect. We can start therapy, things can go well, then they can go bad, then it can go well, then it can go bad. And you just get better and better and better at recognizing the issues, taking a pause before you react. It gets better. gets better.
But don't you think, Mary Kay, that that a lot of people avoid therapy, coaching, counseling because they're afraid to feel? They're afraid to feel. They're afraid that they're going to get stuck in that, you know, they've been living a flat affect because they don't want to deal with, you know, the ups and the downs. And so they say it's easier to feel nothing than to feel the depths of the hurt or the sense of loneliness or abandonment or insecurity or whatever the things are, whatever those shadow aspects are.
So I would question, is it really easier? Mm-hmm. Is it really? If I asked myself that question, the answer is no, it's not easier. Maybe it's familiar and I can keep doing it in familiar, but you're living your life in this neutral gear. And think of, you know, putting a car in neutral, you can push it forward. Some other external force can push it backwards. So you feel like you have neutral affect. Well, you're also in neutral and at the expense or whim of all the external factors around you.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you may have, or you will experience some of the bad emotions and the pain, I guess, that's not a reason to not do this. Sorry for the double negative there. Because there's more, like there's more to life. And then as soon as you get a taste of there's more, right? Like one of the reasons like why my brother didn't turn out the same way I did. Then it's like, oh my God, there's an entire buffet out there and there's tons of buffets and I don't have to pick a dish, right? I can taste, I can have more of that one and more of this one and more of that one. And so, yeah, there's more out there, people, and it's not always going to be puppies and rainbows and butterflies. And,
right.
Well, maybe butterflies. yeah, and you will be okay. You will be okay. And you have the power to create your life and to enjoy whatever's happening right now. Savor the moments, find the bright side.
I was going to say, even in the more challenging moments, because I think two things that, you know, it's hard when you're experiencing the challenge in the moment to think of what's beyond, you know, like this is feeling really dark and I don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. So that's the one thing. The other thing is, I love this. I read this a long time ago, Leo Buscaglia. I don't know if you're familiar with him. Mm-hmm. He was a professor of love at UCLA. He wrote these really beautiful books. Like he was my first delve into love relationships when I was in my 20s. And he said, you know, so many people suppress because they're used to that flat. You know, they've been taught one to suppress their emotions.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, to the depths that you feel the hurt and the heartache and the pain, to that degree that you know, allow yourself to experience that, the same is true for the up. So if you're only letting yourself feel, you know, this a little bit, I'm over it. And then you're like, it's okay. But if you're like, I'm crying on the floor for 3 hours and I'm feeling awful, it's the same, you know, to that degree, you can feel that, oh my gosh, life is so beautiful. And I feel so much joy and love and appreciation and connection.
Yeah, that's beautiful, Dawn. I so agree with that. I so agree with that. And, you know, even it takes practice.
Mm-hmm.
So practicing something that you can say is in my toolkit, when you do get to those things, so it becomes more of an automatic thing than you having to fish for it and look for it, and you can't pull yourself out of those depths. Practice now when you're not in them.
Mm.
Practice mindfulness. And for me, it's nature. For me, it's getting out in nature with my camera. I'm also a photographer. Getting out in nature and feeling that connection and it reminding me that we're all the same stuff. Me and that tree, we're the same stuff. We just don't look the same. Maybe don't sound the same. But just having that connection to the energy that's in the world. And, you know, for those of us that are spiritual, that connection to source, we all come from the same source. Mm-hmm. That was something that helped me. So the more I practiced that, the better I was able to get through those dark moments and use them even to my benefit.
So how can you develop that sense of awareness? Because I think that's the first step, right?
That is, awareness is the first step of the journey. So I didn't have that until I was around 40 and started working on these things. So a feeling, pain, crying, negative thoughts, those are signals. So you catch yourself having a negative thought about yourself or even about somebody else, or a situation that, you know, the story you're making up in your head about what could happen when you apply for that job. Mm-hmm. Those are signals. And so you congratulate yourself for noticing that, mm-hmm. right? That's the first step of awareness is learning how to notice. And so that's your only task right now until you become more and more aware. You learn how to notice. So noticing the feelings, like I said, the thoughts, even some of the behaviors, questioning some of your reactions to things sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, Mayor, what the heck was behind that?
Right. Yeah.
Because that's what's going to help you develop that space between, Viktor Frankl quote, there's a space between stimulus and response. And it's in that space where we live our lives. And I know it's not the exact way that the quote is said, but it's in that space. So something triggers us or makes us want to react in a certain way, then we choose our reaction. We can actually choose that reaction if we can just make that space a little bit bigger so that we can make the choice and think about it.
Respond versus react.
Practice noticing. And so one of my favorite ways is mindfulness. And I do meditation as well, but mindfulness is what I started with. And to me, mindfulness is for 3 minutes, I'm going to notice what my breath sounds like. That's it. And every time I catch, I'm going to breathe in and out. I'm going to hear it. I'm going to feel it. And every time my mind wanders or I notice it wandering, I'm going to say, way to go, Mary. You noticed. And the more you do that, the more your reward centers in your brain will light up. You're rewarding yourself for noticing, and that'll train you better and better and better to notice and become more aware of what's going on.
And so what happens when you have a freak out reaction? Because you still do. I mean, even if you practice mindfulness, even if you meditate.
That is a great question. So what do I do? Now, I should tell you that when I have things that I feel need to be worried about, I write them down. And then on Sunday mornings, I have a weekly worry time slot. This is a time where I'm going to look at all those things and go, okay, can I solution? Like, what are the barriers? Like, I'm going to coach myself with those things. Sometimes, however, that exercise puts me into a tailspin. And what that feels like is picture your thoughts. You have all these thoughts and they're all running in different directions. They're all running around. And there are times that I can't pull myself out of it. And I know that I'm just spinning and spinning and spinning. At some point, there is something inside me that taps me on the shoulder and goes, oh, you know what? You can call your friend. You can send an SOS text. And some of the people that we mutually know get some of those texts. And they're, you know, on call, on demand, most of the time. So phone a friend, you know, that's one thing that I could do. write things down. So yes, I'm in my weekly worry time slot, and yes, I'm spinning, but I could also write this down too. Is there anything new? Excuse me, that's coming up. And saying it's okay. So a lot of times I do go back. I go back to my 7-year-old self. I picture her. Would I tell her she's being an idiot? Would I tell her she's being a baby? Would I tell her some of the negative self-talk that is coming up in that spiral,
right,
as I'm having an anxiety moment?
Right. What's the matter with you? Get over it.
I'm going to put my arm. Exactly. We'd never speak to a child like that. Well, we wouldn't speak to anybody like that, really. But I picture her with her ringlets and, you know, whatever she had back then. And I have a picture actually down here. And I talk to myself as if I'm talking to her, as if I'm talking to that child. And that calms me down, makes me feel good, makes me feel like I'm doing something good for myself and 7, 8, 9-year-old Mary. So those are some of the things that I do when I catch myself. And sometimes I don't catch myself. I have the meltdown or the reaction, and then it passes. Right? I go through it and it passes.
What do you want your son to learn the most from all the lessons that you've learned or the ways that you've grown?
You know, I want him to live with optimism. I want him to be self-aware. So I actually have an acronym, because these are my core values and the qualities I look for in other people and the qualities that I think I've tried to model for my son. So self-awareness, optimism, compassion for yourself and for other people, kindness. So it's SOCKS. The acronym is SOCKS, SOCKS. Self-awareness, optimism, compassion, kindness, and spirituality. And so that's what I want him to take away, his own acronym. So maybe it's not mine. I want him to have his own acronym for how to live.
And do you feel like, you know, how do you feel that he's learned these lessons from you?
He has. Well, in one way, he tells me, you know, now as he's older, he tells me that he's learned this from me and that from me. And he always says that he got the best qualities out of from me and from his dad. He's like all the good qualities in one.
That's nice.
So there was a time a couple of years ago, he used to ride his bike between my house and his dad's house before he was driving. And on the sidewalk, because the street that his dad lives on is a kind of a main road. It's very busy. So he'd ride on the sidewalk. He would move if somebody was walking on the sidewalk. And one day this lady told him off, like really told him off as she's walking towards him, like, expletive, like, you shouldn't be, get off the sidewalk. You need to be on the road. And he said, normally, Mom, I would have flipped her the bird. I would have told her where to go. But you were in my head, Mom. You were in my head. I thought, for her to be reacting like that to me, what's going on in her day? Or what is she going home to?
Wow.
You were in my head, Mom. So I just said, wow, have a nice day, and kept riding. And he comes home and he was excited to tell me this. I mean, he's an 18-year-old.
That's a huge mature awareness that many adults never have.
I know. I'm so proud of him. He's such a good human. Because my responsibility, can I swear?
Yes, of course.
Okay. My responsibility is, I do not want to send an asshole out into the world. That is my greatest responsibility. So I have to model that for him. And maybe he didn't see it from age, you know, 0 to 5 and 6 and 7 as I'm working on myself, but he certainly saw it for the decade after that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and even when they see, you know, when you're being an asshole, is that we all are sometimes. Right.
Yeah.
We all have our moments, tired, hungry, you know, stressed, whatever the reason is, you know, we all behave like jerks. And I remember that was one of the biggest things that I wanted to teach my kids. It's like, yeah, we all are jerks, but when you are a jerk, you know, when you're acting like a jerk, that you take responsibility, you know, that you don't just walk away and go, oh, well, too bad. You know, it's like you come to the people that you were a jerk to and say, I'm really sorry. You know, I had, for whatever reason, you know, and I'm sorry. Like, I apologize. I'm taking responsibility for it. And, you know, please forgive me. You know, this is something that I'm working on, or, you know, I need to learn better ways of coping when I feel stressed, that, so that you are accountable to the people that you care about. And that you recognize, you know, we all have our moments and we all need both self-compassion. Like you said, huge compassion for the other.
Huge.
And extend that grace, you know.
Yeah. Extend that grace to that you extend to others, to ourselves. And forgiveness is, forgiving ourselves is huge. That's probably the hardest thing.
Why do you think that's so hard?
I think because you were there. Like, you know your thoughts. When you said that bad thing, you knew that you shouldn't say it, and yet you still said it. So it's almost, you're holding yourself to a higher standard than you hold other people, because you're privy to the whole conversation that's going on in your head before you do that thing. Whereas with somebody else, maybe you're not, you can guess. I think it's because we hold ourselves to a really, really high standard. And perfectionism too. I think that still rears its head in my life. So yeah, harder. But I still do it. I still do what I need to do to get to that point of forgiveness of myself, because that's important. I don't want to bury it. I don't want to go back to that pre, the first act of my life, pre 40.
But I think that perfectionism, Mary Kay, is that people pleasing.
Yeah.
Like, I have to live up to some skewed expectation standard that's completely unrealistic, because, you know, like, spiritually, I think that we're pure, perfect, whole and complete, you know, beings as a soul, but our humanity is that messy part.
Yeah.
And so why, you know, misconception of perfectionism is bogus. It's just bogus.
Yeah.
There's no such thing.
It is bogus. And reminding ourselves of that, I think, is a great way to bridge that path to forgiving ourselves for whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you brought that up.
I remember in my master's program, there's, I think her woman, this psychologist's name is Honeycutt. Her name is Honeycutt. Mm-hmm. And she talked about being the good enough parent.
I love that. Know,
not the perfect parent, but the good enough parent. Like, your kid sees you screw up. Your kid sees, you know, you have your stresses and you react in poor ways. But that when you are good enough, you still, you know, provide a safe and secure environment for your kids. And your kids know that you love them unconditionally, even if you get mad at them, even if you say, I love you, but I don't like you right now. Even, and your kids know that no matter what happens to them, no matter if they get into trouble or they do stuff, stupid stuff, that you'll always be there for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you'll have their back and their best interests at heart and mind. And I feel like that's the version that we need to live. This, I'm good enough.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Good enough is good enough.
Good enough is it. That's the standard. And not just good enough, like, I'll make fun of myself because I don't cook. I'm terrible. So we have a lot of frozen food that we put in the microwave with the oven. And it's like, okay, well, I'm not a good enough cook or house cleaner, or, you know, I'm just not very domestic. I'm more creative, you know, creative, visionary, whatever. And so I think, oh, I'm a horrible mom. It's like, Yeah, so my kids would, yes. You know, like somebody to cook better for them. But do they know that I love them? You betcha.
Yeah.
Do they know that I'm here for them, even if sometimes they don't want to talk to me? You betcha.
That's brilliant, Dawn. And, you know, I think even if there's only one tiny takeaway from your episode here is what you said. Just adopt that good enough thing for the rest of your life, for the rest of your day. Like, that is powerful. Huge.
But that good, I mean, that is also about having compassion for yourself, that awareness, that self-care, that connection to your spirit, you know, the sense of kindness. It's like, treat others the way you want to be treated, including yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, beautiful.
So what kind of work, tell us about your work with these millennials.
So I work with millennials in my corporate job. The people I work with when in my coaching practice are actually mostly Gen Xers. Mm-hmm. That's really the main audience for my coaching. Although I know that there are some millennials that are benefiting from it in my corporate job. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a way, because I have the experiences that I've had, and because I've taken control. So after age 40, after I changed careers and was on my own, then I was like off like a rocket, doing everything, learning everything and experiencing everything, and being able to go from being an introvert, if you can believe it, to an extrovert. Like, I was an introvert, and I've got my own podcast now. Like,
wow,
who would have thunk it?
I know, I was going to ask you about that.
So and now, of course, I've lost, you know, I get, and in my excitement, I've lost my train of thought and what your original question was.
Well, okay. How do you coach people? I mean, do you talk mostly about these similar struggles, these similar struggles with both Gen X and millennials?
Yeah. So, you know, and anybody who comes to me that's looking for coaching, we're really going to focus on clarity. Mm-hmm. So the framework that I use in my program is something I made for myself. It's called the FLASH framework. So find, learn, action, stop, and happy. Well, I'll address the first couple of things quickly. So finding where are they now? Mm-hmm. Who are they? What are they? What are their core values? Because a lot of it is that they're coming to me because they're out of alignment, but they can't articulate yet, what am I out of alignment with?
Right, right.
Like, why does my job not fit me anymore? Well, let's find out. Let's at least figure out where you are right now and where your core values are right now. What does that look like? So that we can then craft a vision for your life that aligns to that. So perhaps you're a lawyer that wants to be a barista. Okay. So how are we going to get you there? Mm-hmm. How are we going to get you there? And I did have somebody in my past that was on that road, and they, once they got their vision clear, it was that they wanted to roast coffee beans. They wanted to have their own coffee shop. It wasn't just that they wanted to go and be somebody else that they see. They wanted to develop this thing around coffee and roasting coffee. Mm-hmm. So it's developing the vision and develop and understanding who you are, your shadows. So that's the find part. It's the discovery part. Then your vision. Like, what are the possibilities available to me? Like, I'm 45, 50, 55, whatever. I've got all these years of experience behind me. Of course, you've got transferable skills if it's your career. Let's look at all the possibilities. So I'll get them to do searches on what else can a software developer do? What other careers can a software developer do? And Dawn, you'd be surprised with the stuff that comes up.
Really? Like, okay. What? Like what?
But they didn't think of it. they didn't think of it. So a software developer could be a, could become a project manager. They could become a consultant on change management, for example, technology. They could, well, they could probably become a real estate agent if they wanted to. That might not have been one of the things that turned out, but it's just a matter of helping the person understand that there's a whole bunch of possibilities out there that maybe they haven't thought of before.
Right.
And that's right. The fine part in Flash. And flashlight, camera flash or flashlight, right? We're shining a light on this stuff, the shadows. And then here's your vision. What do you need to learn in order to get you from where you are now to there? Like, what's, do you need to take a course? Maybe. Do you need to learn how to roast coffee beans? Right? I don't know what it is. So there's a learning aspect, and then there's an action plan. So the A stands for action. What actions can I take? And sometimes that action plan is agile. It's iterative, right? So if new information comes at you because you're still doing your homework, you can change that action plan and adjust it.
Of course.
And maybe your aim is now, instead of your aim being like super laser focused on this one thing, maybe you adjust it 1 degree and now you're aiming for similar,
right?
Direction. Doesn't have to be that thing, but you've got this new information, right?
Right.
Make use of it. We're humans. Like, we're built to adapt.
Adaptable.
And then there's this
adaptability.
Much better than resiliency, right?
Yeah.
Adaptable, flexible. So then there's the S and the H. The S stands for stop. So pick a time. So for, you know, when I'm coaching someone, it's usually a weekly session. That counts as a stop. We're going to see, okay, what's working? Start, stop, continue. What's working? What's not working? What can I stop? What can I start? What can I continue to keep moving me down this path towards the life that lights me up? Mm-hmm. And then the happy. So I have my clients document their even their tiniest accomplishments.
Mm-hmm.
Put them in a list. Put them somewhere where you keep adding to them, right? Because the idea, the psychology behind it is that it's the progress principle. They're going to be able to see their progress. And if they get down on themselves in any way, just open that up.
Right.
Look at all the things I just did today or yesterday or a week ago. And that's the happy part. And then celebrate. Do a little. So for me, and you're going to laugh at me, you know the song, Another One Bites the Dust? That is my celebratory song. And a lot of people use it in a different way. But I use it as soon as I accomplish something, like I'm going to whip out my phone and I'm going to, on my playlist, Another One Bites the Dust. Like, celebrate it somehow. Music is one way for me. Other people, it could be some other reward, but music, it's free. It's always there.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just going outside and getting a breath of fresh air. So
yeah.
Flash, find, learn, action, stop, happy.
Beautiful.
We can all
use that little game plan.
Yeah.
Because we're constantly growing and evolving. Exactly. So you've created something beautiful from having this epiphany.
Mm-hmm.
Epiphany, like, stop the insanity. I mean, that's what it, you know.
I love that phrase. Mm-hmm. Stop the insanity, which reminds me back in the 80s. Yeah. I think there was a woman that was
there was
stop the insanity fitness.
I met her.
No way.
Yeah.
Too funny. But see how a phrase sticks in your mind?
Uh-huh.
It's amazing.
Uh-huh. So what a beautiful example you are for your kid, for your son.
Thank you.
I mean, he's not a kid, but you know, for your son. And you have such beautiful energy. I mean, we were talking before about being the lighthouse, and you certainly are. You certainly are, Mary Kay.
Likewise, Dawn.
Likewise. Thank you. All right. So for my last question that I ask every guest is, because this podcast is called Wake Up to Real Love. How do you define real love?
Ooh, real love. Real love to me is something that I am giving, being. I'm not looking for love. I'm living with love. So, and then to define what that is, I love you no matter who you are, or what you do, there is love that's coming from me to you. So if you're a stranger, for example, or let's put it this way, maybe it's somebody in my life that has done something to hurt me. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to send them love. I'm going to send them positive things. I don't know what's going on with them. Maybe it's personal, maybe it's not. I'm going to try not to take it personally. But I guess what I'm saying is it's unconditional, positive energy towards another human. And that includes myself. It includes me.
That's the most important relationship you'll ever have.
Absolutely.
The one you have with yourself. Yeah. And that, I mean, that's the message and mantra of the podcast, that, and that no matter what you've been through or no matter what you're currently going through, that you're worthy of love.
Yes.
We all are.
Yes. We
good
all
enough.
Are.
Good enough. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to fix. You're not broken.
Enough. GE.
Yeah.
So now every time I see a GE appliance, I'm going to think good enough.
So how do people get in touch with you, Mary Kay?
Thank you. Oh, how can people get in touch with me?
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm on a high being on your show, you know. It's so funny. The energy that comes from you, it Aww. Makes my energy go everywhere. So people can get
Thank
in touch
you.
With me at mkranger.com. Go there, you'll find my Facebook link as well, my Instagram link, soon to be TikTok link. I'm starting to make TikTok videos.
But and my website is not coaching. It's just MK
no,
Ranger.
It's MK.
Okay.
KRanger.com.
Yes. Okay.
I made it easy.
Okay.
Yeah.
You said something about your website.
Yes, that's my website. MKRanger.com is my website, and you can get to every other place that I'm on from there.
And your articles?
My articles. So most of my articles are on medium.com. And if you look for MKRanger or Mary K. Ranger, you'll find me on medium.com. Go to Paranormal Daily News, sign up for that newsletter, because I've written some articles for that organization. I'm actually now on the editorial team.
Cool.
So those are things related to the paranormal. And also Spy Witness News, which is a little more news related, world news. Again, Mary Kay Ranger everywhere if you want to find my writing.
Cool. You're beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on, Dawn. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you. So, I mean, I love these conversations because it, you know, because I resonate with you so much anyways. And I just feel like we shared. I forgot to say before we started that I always say, dear God, creator, universe, source of all that is, please guide us to speak about what people most need to hear. And all of the things that you are talking about, I think so many people struggle with in their life, you know, trying to live up to somebody else's standards, trying to live up to somebody else's expectations, struggling with not feeling good enough, you know, not worthy, and then saying, you know, I'm living my life in this flat place and there has to be something more than that. So you are a beautiful example of, I'm going to create something new for my life.
Yeah. Thank you. Creativity.
And you've created a lot. So for all the listeners, you know, please subscribe to the Wake Up to Real Love podcast. Leave 5-star reviews. It helps.
Yeah.
Share with anybody that you feel would benefit from this conversation. You know, we are all here, you know, Mary Kay and I, and all my guests, we're trying to be lighthouses out in the world to help, you know, create more love and light and lift the consciousness of the planet. So, and for anybody who wants to get in touch with me, you can find me on all the socials at either The Awakening with Dawn or Dawn Richard, R-I-S-H-A-R-D, and send me a message if you, you know, have suggestions on what you'd like to hear more of. But I'm, you know, I'm so grateful that you're here today, Mary Kay. I really, really love having you because, you know,
thank you so
I
much.
Love you. Yeah. Thank you. So everyday listeners, wake up to more and more real love. We'll see you next time. Take care.
Subscribe to the Wake Up to Real Love podcast. Leave 5-star reviews. And of course, share with your friends. You can find Dawn on various social media platforms at Dawn Richard or at The Awakening with Dawn.